6 inches of sand all inside of the piece of 1-inch diameter tubing. And now I take this 3/4-inch diameter dowel and I start pushing down on the top of the sand because I want to push the sand and the tissue paper out of the bottom of the tubing. Got the picture? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, let me see if I've got it right. This piece of copper tubing is being held in the vise horizontally. Is that correct?
Nope, I said it 3 times. It's being held upright, vertical. It's perpendicular to the ground. So, the piece of tubing is perpendicular to the ground. The bottom of the tubing has got the tissue paper with rubber band. The 6 inches worth of sand that has been poured into the 1-inch diameter tubing, while it's held in the vise vertically, I'm now taking this vertical 3/4-inch diameter wooden dowel, and I'm pushing down on the top of the sand inside of that tubing. I'm trying to ram the sand down and trying to remove the, tissue paper out of the bottom of that 1-inch diameter copper tubing. Over to you, John.
Okay, now I understand. So you're trying to force the sand down, which is going to push out the tissue paper, but because the sand is displacing that force, it's not applying it to the paper.
You got it. I now can put probably hundreds of pounds of force, maybe thousands of pounds of force, on that dowel, and I will not move that sand and that tissue paper. The way the grains of sand will dissipate the force horizontally, it's grabbing onto the inside sides of the copper tubing, and the resistance of the sand being rammed against the side of the copper tubing is jamming it. And so even though I'm applying 200 pounds of force on the top of the sand, 6 inches further down, the tissue paper probably feels, you know, 1 extra ounce of force, and that's it. The sand dissipates the force horizontally, and it grabs onto the tubing in that manner. When you actually see this demonstration, it's hard to believe. Are you slightly in the believable mode in what I've described so far? Over to you, John.
Okay, let me give you a slight extrapolation. So now, if we had that copper tubing rotating with the sand in it, and we had a dowel on each end, as we pushed that in to compress the sand, we would be able to control the speed of the copper. Is that what you're saying?
Good guess. No, that's not it at all yet. All I'm saying is that when you've got sand-like particles, and they can be round particles or cubical particles or particles that are made like a little bitty bullet-shaped object, doesn't matter. These fine-grained sand cannot be rammed out of that pipe by a simple force on top of the sand. It dissipates the energy horizontally, even though it's opposite of common sense. If now, while you've got a 200-pound weight pushing down on that 3/4-inch diameter dowel, if I walk over there with my straight pin and make a very small hole in the tissue paper and the sand starts draining out, let's assume now that, let me start off with a full 12 inches worth of sand in this 2-inch tall copper tubing, and I've got a 3-foot long dowel. So I've got 12 inches of sand, and I've now made a small hole in the tissue paper so that the sand is slowly dropping out, and there's 200 pounds of weight continuously pushing down on that dowel. Can you envision that as the sand slowly drops out of the bottom of the tissue paper, for every inch of sand that drops down, the dowel will move down by 1 inch and stop, and it will never burst the tissue paper until you get down to about 1 or 2 inches worth of sand. Then for the first time you'll break through. Can you see how just by letting out that sand slowly, I can take this tremendous weight and slowly lower it in that manner? By the way, there was a movie about the pyramids where the rocks were moved in place at the time the pyramids were being sealed. They were being sealed by sand pistons that worked in this manner. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
I'm aware of that. I saw the same movie. Yeah, and that's been done for centuries. Okay, so carry on. Let's hear the rest of it. Back to you, Dick.
And by the way, if I had a very strong spring that applied 200 pounds of force between between the dowel and the tubing. And now the spring is applying the force. It's not a weight. And I pick up the structure out of the vise, and I suddenly tip it upside down, and the sand starts draining out of the top of the tubing. You can see that in very short order, the dowel would again go ramming right through the tissue paper as the sand dropped out of that mechanism. Can you see that one, John? KQRIW?
Absolutely.
So these particles, when they're in the right position, have this tremendous amount of not obvious horizontal force. Now, when you look at the cross-section of that Warner device, and look at it, you'll see that there is a inner cylinder and an outer cylinder that have a very close spacing between the two. The cylinders are only maybe an inch or two long, front to back, but the cylinders are, oh, let me pick a number, 6 inches or so in diameter, maybe 8 inches in diameter. And the cylinders have a very close clearance between the two. The outer cylinder is connected to the, let me call it the stator, and the inner cylinder is connected to the rotor shaft. And now you've got these magnetic particles between the two. As you apply the magnetic field, and the magnetic particles decide to grab, to align themselves in between the inner cylinder and the outer cylinder, which, by the way, are also made out of magnetic materials, at least I think they are, the gathering of those particles in between the inner cylinder and the outer cylinder with a very close spacing, again, have this kind of an effect where when you want to slide one versus the other, turn one cylinder versus the other cylinder, the way the particles are packed in there is not too different from what's going on with this dowel being pushed through the sand and that one-inch diameter piece of tubing. And now, how tightly are those particles packed in there is a function of how strong is the magnetic field. That's the mechanism by which there's a direct linear relationship between current flowing into the coil, converting a different amount of, causing a different amount of magnetic field, and a different amount of magnetic field packing between the inner cylinder and the outer cylinder, which determines the amount of friction, so to speak, you get between those, created by the sand effect. And the nice thing about that as a drag device is it has no stick and slip capability. And it's a very linear relationship of amount of drag versus current that you apply and nearly instantaneous operation. That's a very crafty device. That phenomena was quite possibly going on inside of those tensioning devices that you've seen on this paper rolling machines that I think you've worked on in the past. KC2WGB, KQLIW.
2QIQ with a comment.
Okay, Glenn. But Dick, wouldn't that generate a tremendous amount of heat?
Absolutely. The amount of joules that you're dissipating. You tell me how much force there is between object one that is moving against object two. You tell me the force. You tell me the distance. You tell me the rate. A joule is 1 newton meter. You apply a force of 1 newton, you apply it for 1 meter of length, and if you do it in 1 second of time, then you are generating 1 joule per second of heat. You and I call that 1 watt. 1 watt is 1 joule per second. So no matter how you do it, whether it is a dragging brake pad between the rotor and the brake pads on an automobile, no matter whether it be the fluid clutch that you've got in a hydraulic in a fluid drive transmission system, no matter what the force is, no matter what the rate is, no matter what the velocity and time, you always are dissipating the exact amount of heat, depending on how much force and how much velocity, and for what period of time. That's an exact formula. So yes, you are generating a tremendous amount of heat, and each one of these has a curve telling you how many watts it can dissipate. KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
Hey, what's interesting about this device, Dick, looking at the cross-sectional area of it, I think you described it very, very well about the inside cylinder and the outside cylinder, but that little inside, what you're calling the small inside cylinder that's attached to the shaft, apparently appears to be magnetic, and the outside cylinder is also magnetic, and the coils around the outside, basically cutting lines of force. But if I were to look at that in that in the geometry, the way it's displayed in front of me, I would say that, that if you apply no power to that at all, that's a break. In other words, I think you'd have a very, very hard time trying to turn that shaft until you apply some kind of power. Back to you, the K2RZ and the K2QIQ.
In this Warner magnetic particle clutch and brake, blue first page, the next page has no number on it, and the third page is really labeled page number one, lower right-hand corner. In blue, it's page number one. If I look in that cross-sectional diagram, the magnetic particles are that greenish-blue area between the inner rotor and the outer. The inner rotor is connected to the so-called output shaft that goes to the left. The outer rotor is connected to the input shaft that goes to the right. Notice that there is a salmon-colored hole, vertical hole, that goes between the blue particle area and the red coil area. And the reason for that is you want the magnetic field to not take the short circuit through the scatter mechanism. You want the magnetic field to go down through the right-hand side of the scatter, through the rotor, come back up through the left-hand side of the scatter, and then back into the magnetic coil circuit. First of all, are you seeing that same diagram I'm seeing, Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RAW?
I hope so. in other words, I see everything described, like steel input shaft, zinc chromate, plating surfaces, the shaft, basically the housing, which I'm calling cylinder one, and the part that's connected to the stator, or the stainless steel input shaft. But I'm not seeing anything red in there.
The diagram that shows a isometric cutaway diagram, which is described as some of it as zinc chromate plating and all steel surface, that's the upper diagram. Go to the bottom of that page and look at the diagram on the right-hand side. Have you seen that one so far? Go ahead.
Okay, the one that the one next to the torque current curve versus percent of rated current, is that the one that would be on the left-hand side of the page?
You got it. So lower left-hand side of the page is that curve of percent of rated torque, vertical axis, percent of rated current, horizontal axis, and it's called the torque current curve. Now, if I move to the right-hand side of that page, you're looking at a cross-sectional view. That's what I've been describing. First of all, you see the red area, which is the coil. You see the coil is mounted in a ring structure on the outside, and there's air gap between it and the rest of the rotor and stator. So far, do you see that?
Yeah, now I do, because I guess that's what was missing in the other cutaway, was that the magnetic parts with respect to the coil were at 180 degrees, not at 90. Okay, now I see that. Yep. Very good.
Now, depending on the size of the magnetic particles, depending on the density, not density, how tightly packed, how full is the area with magnetic particles, if no magnetic field is flowing, I see the possibility that that inner rotor could turn very freely compared to the outer rotor, particularly if all of those magnetic particles are round, spherical magnetic objects that are right now not being magnetized in any way. They have no permanent magnetism to them. You start applying current to that coil. And let's assume now that the magnetic field flows out of the right-hand side of that upper red coil area. It flows down through the, what I'm going to call the stator, through the blue area where the magnetic particles are, into the rotor, through the rotor left to right, right to left, and then back up all the way to make a complete circle. And you now see that pink area as a vertical rod, so to speak, right above the blue area. You see a pink area where the metal of the rotor has been removed. There's an air gap in there. And that's to make sure that the magnetic field flows between the stator and the rotor without taking the short circuit of only going through the stator. Now that magnetic field, as you apply that magnetic field, it attracts particles that start clumping themselves in between the rotor and the stator in that double cylindrical area. And the density with which they pack themselves in there is a function of the magnetic field that you apply. That's very similar to me changing the thickness of the sand that I pour into that pipe. If I pour 1 inch of sand into that pipe, I can ram it through with that 3/4 inch dowel pretty easily. As I start packing more and more sand, I put 2 inches and 3 inches of sand, I rapidly get to the point where no matter how much force I put...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I will rapidly get to the point where no matter how much force I put on the dowel, I will not push out that tissue paper without first bursting the copper pipe. That's just the way sand at various densities works. Over to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's a very interesting device because everything is distributed the way that this goes. But yeah, I absolutely agree. With zero current in this thing, that shaft's going to turn very, very freely and until the current is applied. But because, I guess, of the displacement of the particles against the coil, the way that it's mounted to that stator, that once any kind of current is applied along that surface area, it's just going to create a tremendous amount of drag. It's pretty obvious now. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Yes, you said the magic words. It's going to create a tremendous amount of drag. Tell me, what is the drag? Is it magnetic hysteresis drag, or is it physical friction drag of the particles packed in between the rotor and the stator? Over to you, Glenn.
I don't see that the particles can expand in any way. I don't think it is an expansion, Dick. I think it is purely magnetic. But that's just a guess on my part. Do you see something different?
It is my belief that 99.9% of the drag between rotor and stator is frictional drag of the magnetic particles between the rotor cylinder and the stator cylinder. How tightly you pack those particles is a function of these magnetic particles. How tightly they pack themselves is a function of how strong the magnetic field is. And as you pack them tighter, they want to gather in the center because of that magnetic field. They want to pack themselves between the rotor and the stator. Some of them from outside that area, you know, join that area as you increase the magnetic field by increasing current in the coil. And I say that all of the friction between rotor and stator is mechanical friction of, I'm going to call it, the sand particles.
Comment.
Go ahead, John.
No, excuse me, Dick. Let me just see if I have it for a second.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I have to agree with Dick on this one completely, because it even shows underneath here. It says disengagement. When the DC current is removed, the magnetic power is free to move within the cavity, allowing the input shaft to rotate freely. So, Dick, that's exactly as you're explaining it. In other words, that the powder is free to move, so it is friction, absolutely. K2RIW, KC2QIQ, with John to get it.
Okay, well, my question is, it may not be full to the top. Magnetic attraction causes them to collect, just like Dick said. But, and then when you drop the power, of course, they'll fall back into free-flowing mode. Maybe some of it will fall like an hourglass down below, and the thing spins freely. But if what you said is true, Dick, the wear on the shaft for those magnetic particulates is going to be tremendous. I don't see how it could last. I think it's magnetic coupling that's causing the drag. But back to you.
John, if it was magnetic coupling, why would you bother putting in the magnetic particles?
To bring the field closer. You're actually expanding the metallic part of the rotor.
If only the magnetic coupling was creating the hysteresis drag, I could very easily get that by simply decreasing the spacing between rotor and stator. I make the spacing between rotor and stator go down to 1/10,000th of an inch, and now I apply the magnetic field. Why wouldn't that do it without the particles?
I'm not sure, but the amount of particles that are collected, okay, are they going to close drag? Yes, they're going to close drag. I don't think that's the full thing. I think it's more the coupling, but you may be right. It may have something to do with the transition between on and off, and the perfect control that they can get with this device. I mean, it does respond almost instantaneously.
The old-fashioned mechanical speedometer on an automobile with a speedometer cable had a rotating magnet inside of an aluminum cup. Have you ever seen a schematic diagram of those things and how they work? John, go ahead.
The original ones that were two weights that started to separate as the cable spun faster and faster, and those weights caused the little pearl rod to move the meter. But I know the one you're talking about, the magnetic one.
Did Dick have something to add to this, too?
Yeah, back to John first. You're describing a so-called governor mechanism, but all of the later ones that had longevity to them really were a rotating magnet inside of an aluminum cup that operated against a hairspring, similar to the kind of spring you've got in the escapement mechanism of an old-fashioned mechanical watch, and that applied a very gentle force that moved your speedometer indicator between 0 and 100 miles an hour. It created a very small amount of force. We'll get back to this. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I guess to address the wear mechanism that you were concerned about, John, there's one of the sheets in there is called selection, and it calls out sizing and the selection chart. So now it apparently they've taken the loss factors into account, and you can look at the graphs. In other words, depending on how much drag and how much power, in other words, if you're going to use what RPM and what power you're looking to dissipate, the graphs are actually shown there for 10 watts, 20, 100, and 140. So, in other words, and you can look at the graph versus torque in inch pounds. So, in other words, they basically give you an equation and a sizing factor so that depending on how much load, so in other words, as long as you stay within those curves of loading power and braking, I guess the life is guaranteed. But you're right, in other words, you wouldn't want to run it outside of that because then you could burn it up. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, that's a good point because on the sheet presses, you can't have that kind of heat. Set fire to the press. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, each one of these things, depending on how well they're sized, have a finite number of watts they can dissipate. But now, let me ask you this question. I go back to my 1-inch diameter copper aluminum pipe, vertically mounted in a vise, and I've got 6 inches worth of sand in there, and I've got my 3/4-inch diameter rod or dowel pushing down on it with 200 pounds of force with a spring. Between the dowel and the piece of tubing, I got a 200-pound spring, great big long coil spring, applying continuous force. And I've got the small hole in the bottom of the tissue paper, and I'm letting the sand slowly drop out, and I'm watching the 3/4-inch diameter dowel slowly descend. And finally, it gets down to the bottom, almost to the point where it's going to burst through the tissue paper, and I stop the action by putting my finger on that small hole. I take the spring apart. I raise the 3/4-inch diameter dowel. I pick up the sand from the bowl that I've been gathering it. I pour the sand back in, and I repeat the process. If I kept repeating that process over and over again, hey, John, how long would it take for me to wear out that sand? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
You're never going to wear out that sand. But if you put it between two steel blocks and rub the blocks, you're going to grind the sand to nothing. And you're right about the pipe, Dick, because if you've ever had a pipe that was stuck with just tissue paper and you try to ram the snake down there, can't do it. Tissue paper, you're right. Won't do it.
K2YO, disagreement on destruction of sand?
Yeah, go ahead, Bernie.
I'm going to say that you can't destruct the sand. So what, you grind the sand into smaller and smaller particles. As long as you don't let any of the smaller particles escape, you just have smaller sand.
Yeah, you're saying grinding. If I've got a 1-inch diameter copper pipe filled to the 6-inch level with sand with a piece of tissue paper on the bottom, and I got a 3/4-inch diameter dowel, 3/4-inch diameter dowel pushing down on the sand in a 1-inch diameter pipe, I'm not grinding up the sand. Yeah, if I put particles of sand between two sheets of steel and I move the two sheets of steel back and forth, yes, I can do some grinding of that steel. But I've got a 1/4-inch gap between the diameter of the wooden dowel and the inside diameter of the 1-inch copper pipe. There's no grinding mechanism in there, if you know what I mean. That's pure piston action, and the crazy way the sand distributes its force horizontally into the pipe and creates a tremendous amount of friction that the tissue paper does not see. By the same token, these spheres that are in between, these magnetic spheres that are very fine powder-like substance that packs itself in between the cylinder and the outer cylinder of this brake mechanism, this magnetically actuated brake mechanism, which has no clutch plates. There is no clutch plates to this thing. It's just an inner rotor and an outer rotor with a close spacing between the two. The spacing is wide enough that you do not grind the magnetic particles. The magnetic particles just pack themselves in there like the sand. When I'm operating that sand piston, I am not grinding that sand. Even if I tried, a wooden dowel would not grind sand. And by the same token here, if I choose the right kind of softness and hardness of these materials, and the right spacings, and the right diameters of the magnetic spheres, magnetic powder, I'm creating friction, but I'm not grinding it. And if I do it just right, I'm not changing the magnetic particles, the little spherical particles, do not change between the beginning and the end of the process. I wonder if that makes some sense, Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you, Dick. I'm disagreeing with John. John was saying, well, I think you can still place and grind it. I don't think, even if you ground the sand down to smaller parts, it's not going to matter. The granularity of the sand really doesn't make a difference in the process you're describing.
Yeah, they don't seem to talk about a finite life of these machines. As long as you use them within their maximum wattage rating of the power you dissipate, meaning the RPMs you give them and the amount of inch-pounds of drag that you create. Once you stay within that wattage of dissipation, I think this thing will last as long as your bearings and seals will last. I think there is no real wear mechanism, even though it sounds like there should be. Properly designed, properly used, I think there's no wear mechanism. I'm going to first ask Glenn and then John if they seem to agree with that. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think you should also notice that if you look at not the drawing, but to look at the cutoff of the device, you see the small hole on the top of the vertical disc that is seen between inside, and then you see cut off of the half of the hole at the bottom of it. That's where the particles is. Also, the finite sound that is there is the sound that is offered by the manufacturer as a replacement after a certain amount of hours and to actually end.
KC2QIQ, I'm back.
Yeah, we heard everything you said. And so what Wes is saying, that the magnetic powder cavity, you have these round holes that are in the rotor mechanism. You're led to believe the magnetic powder goes to those inert holes when it's not being used, and only when you apply the magnetic field do they now hop up to that fine space between the rotor and stator and start creating that physical drag because of the way they're packed in there by the strength of the magnetic field. That's what I think is going on here. And so they go to their neutral corner, so to speak, when there's no magnetic field, and they get out of the way. KC2QIQ, K2RAW in the group.
Certainly not being familiar with these things and never using one, I would just suggest that any time that there's friction involved, usually there is some kind of a wear mechanism. But I would think that the wear mechanism here is pretty light, Dick, mainly because, especially when you're dealing with powders in a cavity like this and you're using very, very hard steels, that it would be more of like a polishing effect, if not anything, and that the amount of wear eventually would probably take a real long time. And I would imagine that somebody has already figured out the life expectancy of something like this, where the amount of magnetic particles that they put inside, as opposed to cavity dimensions, in other words, to what point it would actually be worn out, they probably can come up with an MTBF figure on it pretty easily. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I think I'm agreeing with you, Glenn. And I think if it's properly designed, the life expectancy of this machine will be the life expectancy of the ball bearings and the seals on those ball bearings. And so even though some finite amount of wear of the magnetic particles might take place, because they are being physically rubbed against each other, still, I see the possibility of them being rubbed against each other, creating a lot of friction, but not creating a wear mechanism, a grinding mechanism. In other words, it's not chipping off particles. I think it's possible, but there I'm not absolutely sure. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, did I hear Wesley say that the particles are replaceable after so many hours? Is that what he said? Then, ergo, we've got the answer.
Now, I'm going to pass it over to Wesley to see. Have you read of the section where it told you to replace the particles? I don't think that's possible. I think it's relatively difficult to take this thing apart, not lose that powder, get rid of the old powder, and put in just the right amount of new powder. I don't think that's a field replaceable item. Maybe it can be done back at the factory, but I'm having trouble believing that that powder needs replacement. Let's see if Wes Field's onto that one. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, N2XJN. Look. Okay. I'm sorry. Still not sure that I'm going on. Okay. On eBay, you have a kit that you can buy for $24, and it is the replacement for the powder that is made by the manufacturer. But the most important factor that you didn't touch is a line of magnetic flux. If you have a, say, right now, you look at the cutoff of that structure, a vertical coil. Now you have horizontal at 90 degrees magnetic flux on it. And then you try to picture the sound as the loosely packed ferrite. Don't think for now as a magnet, just a ferrite. Now, the ferrites, they become magnetized, and they simply try to oppose that magnetic flux with their own one that they create. I would like you to concentrate on how the mechanics of the magnetic flux impact that powder and pressure.
Okay, you call that a vertical coil. I call that a horizontal coil. In that cutaway diagram, on the lower right-hand corner of page number 1. In my opinion, that when you apply, first of all, if you take a look at the upper cutaway diagram, you can see the way that coil is wound. It is a single solenoid winding of multiple layers of solenoid winding. In the, when I apply current through that coil, it is attempting to generate a magnetic field such that the magnetic field would be in the direction of my thumb when I wrap my hand around that shaft, if you know what I mean. It's trying to make magnetic field lines that are parallel to that shaft. In so doing, when you look at the lower right-hand cutaway diagram and you look at the dotted lines, those dotted lines show you one single magnetic half circle. So the magnetic lines are attempting to go from the right-hand side of the diagram through the blue area toward the left-hand side of the diagram. So the magnetic field is a axial magnetic field. It's not a radial magnetic field. The major portion of the magnetic field, in my opinion, in the vicinity of the blue area, which is the particles, that is a axial magnetic field, not a radial magnetic field, I think. So as you make that magnetic field stronger, you're doing a axial packing of the particles, and the more axial particles you pack in, the more friction you get between rotor and stator. That's my belief, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Well, I have a problem with that, and the reason for that is that if you have a regular coil, the coil is made out of ferrite. There is absolutely no magnetic field outside. The coil is wound on that ferrite. Now, I asked Glenn as he deals with that. Now we have a slightly different situation.
we have a coil inside, but covered with the pipe. So the pipe, a metal pipe, is around the coil. How then the lines of the magnetic flux will react, as they see it?
The red crisscross area on the top and the bottom of the lower right-hand cutaway diagram, those red crisscross areas, are a simple, single solenoid winding. Solenoid winding. When I look at the upper cutaway diagram on page number one, and it says low current coil generates magnetic field. That is a solenoid coil. I'm looking at about 10 layers of solenoid winding. That is very different than a toroidal coil winding. This is an ordinary solenoid magnet. If all of the rest of the structure wasn't there, the magnetic field lines coming out of the structure would be parallel to that shaft, the stainless steel input shaft. The magnetic field lines would be parallel to that. So that's the magnetic field that the coil is attempting to make. When you look at the lower right-hand cutaway diagram, and you look at the dotted lines, those dotted lines represent one single loop of magnetic field, and you think you're seeing an upper one, and you're thinking you're seeing a lower one at the bottom of that diagram. In reality, that's the way the magnetic field is flowing around the whole perimeter of this circular object. But the magnetic field lines that go through the rotor are always going from the aft direction towards the forward direction as those magnetic field lines go through that rotor. So the magnetic field lines that go through the rotor are essentially parallel to the blue area that shows you the area of the magnetic particles. That's what I see. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Okay, N2XJN. What you're actually saying is that what you see inside the winding is no insulated wire, just looks like a one big chunk of the closed loop. So how then the voltage is connected to that? Also, I read somewhere down the bottom of this article that it takes 5.6 amps. Now, imagine how many amps could flow through the one the conductor that is of the thickness of that cutoff of the coil that I see over there. It's something that is, for me, still not clear.
Can I take this one, Dick?
Well, he's got a bad view of this, Dick. That is definitely a solenoid coil, and those are individual wires.
Yeah, those are individual enameled wires. That is 10 layers of solenoid enameled wire in that coil, in my opinion. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, another possibility here is that because this is a current-driven, I would imagine that the resistance of that coil is very, very low. And if I were going to construct that coil, and it only looks like a two-wire coil because they show two wires coming out of one of these extended views over here. And if I were going to do it, I've made like flat pack, what I call flat pack coils, where they were basically like springs, and basically they were like enamel coated, but basically it was like a spring-like structure where it was a flat surface over lapped very, very closely. So it could be just basically like a spring coil loaded inside there with basically a magnetic coating around the outside to keep the windings from shorting out. K2RIW, K22QIQ.
Yeah, I think there's only one single coil here. One single coil, like the primary of a transformer. It's not wound quite the way you would wind a binary transformer. This is a multi-layer solenoid coil made out of many layers of enameled wire, in my opinion. And I think many of these devices operate with only milliamps of current required, because with enough turns there, you can develop a pretty strong magnetic field across that very small gap. And I don't think it takes very much magnetic field to attract those magnetic particles to go in between the inner cylinder and the outer cylinder and start creating that frictional drag. The main thing I was trying to emphasize in my earlier discussions with John was that rotating magnetic aluminum cup speedometer mechanism fed with a speedometer cable on an old-fashioned analog car, analog speedometer. You only got a fraction of an ounce inch of torque out of that rotating magnet. A rotating magnetic field inside of an aluminum cup, by hysteresis drag, gives you very little force. Whereas they're getting a whole lot of pounds of force here by the way those magnetic particles pack themselves in between that inner cylinder and the outer cylinder. Very similar by the 200 pounds of force I can get when I'm trying to force that sand out of a pipe, if you know what I mean. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay, I think you're right for another reason after Wes's.
Fan. Okay, so we have a coil that is using the magnet wire, and then I don't see how, if two ends of the coils are connected to the power supply, and we have a DC current, or there, I don't see how we do not have a 90 degrees magnetic flux on it.
Before we pass it back to Glenn, do you see the dotted lines on the lower right hand diagram? Over to you, Wes.
Yes, I do.
In my opinion, those dotted lines are one single magnetic path. It shows you that the solenoid coil is trying to make a axial magnetic field, a magnetic field that is parallel to the shaft going through the middle of this machine. That's where it's trying to make a magnetic field. But now, by the way the steel is arranged, the magnetic field gets confined to those dotted lines, and those dotted lines represent one single circle of the magnetic field. So the magnetic field, as it flows through the rotor just below the blue area, it is flowing parallel to the shaft, front to back, so to speak, of the machine, parallel to the shaft. And that orientation of the magnetic field causes those particles to gather in that area, and how tightly they pack themselves from front to back into that cylindrical gap area, how tightly they get packed is a function of how strong is the magnetic field, and how tightly they get packed tells you the amount of force between rotor and stator, frictional force, mechanical frictional force, not too different from my three-quarter inch dowel trying to ram that sand out of that one-inch diameter copper pipe. Very similar frictional force. KCQQIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, another interesting thing about the frictional force that's being used on these magnetic particles, that once that coil starts being energized, then the magnetic path, because the they're particles, in other words, they're not fixed like a toroid, they begin to take the shape of the magnetic field. So the magnetic field is actually determining the direction of the magnetic particles. And what's also interesting to note about this design is that if you look at where the input shaft is and the location of the magnetic particles, they're as close to the outer diameter as possible, because better amount of breaking force that you can actually get on this would be to start grabbing that disc on the outermost part of the diameter away from the shaft as possible, because it takes much more force and friction to try to grab the shaft at the center. But the further you get away from the center, it actually adds a little bit of mechanical advantage there as well. So it's a very unique design. I'm going to pass it back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I think you've got it, Glenn. Go ahead, John.
Looking at this construct now, I think you and Glenn are absolutely right, because we do not have enough mass in that disc to make magnetic coupling work, so it has to be friction. I agree.
K2WILE.
Go ahead, Danny.
Just FYI, 10-minute warning.
Roger, Dodger. And I will have to leave at midnight because of an obligation I've got tomorrow. Would you like to have a little more discussion on the Faraday cage, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW?
By the way, on my QRZ site, if you look at that site now, you'll see the measurements instrument displayed, and next to it is the the small heat kit, 1250. And so if you want to see the size of that, that'll give you a good thing. But I do have one question on the coupler. If I terminate that coupler in a perfect 50-ohm load, I will have nothing at the sampling port. Is that correct?
And to explain, we forgot completely about Rogorsky coils, which is being used for the transient current measurement.
Yeah, no, we're going over to the Faraday cage now. Of the pictures that are on your QRZ.com website, that's the one you're talking about, which picture number should I be looking at, John? Go ahead.
Just scroll down until you get to the measurement grid dip meter, and next to it you'll see a case with the other grid dip meter in it.
Yes, I do. That's the blue grid dip meter on the right-hand side. Go ahead.
Okay, that's the one that's small enough to fit in that cage. That's the battery-operated one that I was doing those experiments with. But I was wondering if I was correct on that directional coupler question.
On a quick break, did you get a chance to read the 3 centimeter, 10 gigahertz directional coupler article that I wrote? Did you get a chance to read that one, John? Go ahead.
Yes, I went to Roadrunners and Microwave, and I did not see a credit for that article in your name. Your name is not mentioned anywhere on that site.
Oh, hold on now. When you go to k5rmg.com,
went to,
and then you go to the technical articles
forum,
technical forum, and then you go to the bottom of the technical forum, it says the K2RIW corner, and when you go to the article itself, inside of the article, I've identified myself inside of the article as the very first line of the article. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll double check that, but the article's there, well written, and I saw no mention of your name. You know, they've got the picture of the Roadrunner right on there when it comes up, and you go right to the technical forum, and it says, but I didn't see your name there. But I will check that again.
First of all, when you went to the bottom of the technical forum and you found the K2RIW corner, did you see 10 individual articles listed and you happened to be interested in article number 1 of the 10? Did you see those 10 articles named? Over to you.
No, let me bring it up real quick. Double check.
Okay, as you get a chance to read that article, don't worry, I got plenty of recognition on that one. Both because it's called the K2RIW corner, and the article itself was self-identified within the article. It's got my name and my call letters. Now, when you're putting a perfect dummy load, perfect 50-ohm dummy load on a directional coupler, on the so-called straight through port, on its so-called output, and you've got it positioned in such a way that it's measuring reflected power from the load, from the dummy load, when you've got it positioned in that manner, if the dummy load is perfect, and if the directional coupler has perfect directivity at that frequency, if those two criteria are met, then you will have zero power measured on the coupled port. However, if the dummy load is a little bit deviant from 50 ohms, resistive, or if the directivity of the coupler is not perfect, you will measure some power on the directional coupler port. But that's not bad. Further on in the article, it tells you how to make the directivity of your coupler perfect at your particular frequency, even though your frequency is far away from where the coupler was designed. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, because I'm also going to check the HP and Microdyne very expensive terminators that are 50 ohms. I have those, you know, the shorts, the open and the 50 ohm, and I'm going to use these to test those, which will all, and I have several of these directional couplers, and I might be able to determine which ones are right on the money and which ones aren't. So I'm going to do a very careful examination of all of my test equipment as I go down the line with this.
Do you own any kind of a double stub tuner, double slug tuner? Do you own any kind of a trombone-like tuner, John? Go ahead.
I have a trombone tuner, which I could use to, I could use that on the input or the output. It shouldn't make any difference if I had it on my antenna. I don't know if I want to do that with a dummy load on it.
Well, you're not going to hurt the trombone if you're running low power. And the trombone, if you're going to use it, you're going to be using it only on the output end of the directional coupler, not on the input end. You're going to be changing the line length between the directional coupler and your dummy load. And by using that trombone, assuming the trombone is perfect, if your dummy load was a pure 50 ohms and your trombone was a pure 50 ohms, then sliding the trombone will make no change in the apparent directional power you read in the reflected mode. And if the reflected mode power goes up and down in cycles, but you'd have to have enough trombone that's moving at least 180 degrees, half wavelength at your particular operating frequency, you'd have to have a long enough trombone to do that. If it goes up and down, that's giving you a very strong piece of information, which the bottom of the article addresses. It's going to take a while to absorb all that's in that article. It's a kind of a pithy article. There's a lot more to it than first meets the eye, John. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Well, that whole website, I was reading all kinds of articles on there. What a breadth of information they have on there. Excellent stuff. And some of it pertains to some of the experiments I'm doing. So I'm going to keep hunting that down. I hope by next week I'll have some answers for you.
K2L.
Go ahead, Bernie.
2-minute warning.
Roger, Dodger. Okay, so I guess we gotta start signing off, John. For those who are still listening who hung in there this long, this is TechNet number 1,395 of the TechNet that began back in September of 1982.
Covering part of the rotor.
Just don't get it.
No, that solenoid coil is only making a magnetic field to pull those magnetic particles that are floating in there, those ferrite particles or ferrous particles, up into that area where it will cause the friction on the plate. Dick is right, it's friction. I wasn't looking at that in the proper way. I thought that a rotating disc was much broader, at least the width of the coil. And then when I looked at that other diagram, I saw it is not. It's like an eighth of the size of the coil.
Okay, yeah, well, I was thinking about utilizing this device to my coil winder. If you look at the bottom of that article, they have a graph for different types of the devices. Some of them go from 0 to 2 pounds, some of them go from 0 to 20 pounds, but the thing is that the reaction from the one that goes from 0 to 20 pounds starts only from 2 pounds. From 0 to pounds, there is no action. Now, one of the things that was said is that if there is no voltage, there is a decryption. While I think if there is no current, then there is no friction.
Well, there's going to be some friction, absolutely. It will have a little bit of drag. It's not going to be freewheeling. Like, if you spin it, it's not going to keep spinning, without a doubt. But I think it's overkill for what you're doing because you're winding linear-type coils. You don't really need that kind of control. But, yeah, you buy what you want. I know it'll work, for sure.
No, I understand that perfectly. I have no problem with that. The thing is that if I have something for pennies, then I could use it. But if they ask for it 100 bucks, no, thank you. I don't want it. You know, it's just, it's not only that. When you have that, they suggest to use a whole electronic, a controller, and a sensor for the tension. So now you have a bunch of stuff. Yes, if I get it for the price of scrap, I can use it. But if I have to pay for it, no.
Yeah, well, you could build a DC supply in a pot and vary it and control it that way, or you could do a servo loop with feedback and have it automatically do it, but that would get very involved.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not looking at anything complicated, but the gold mine that I found with this stuff is, I mean, you can buy extremely complicated press with the touch part controller. There is a bunch of the electronics for $400. Why, this device must have cost $20,000. So, yes, the place that I'm digging right now is really good source. And these guys, they are no geeks. They have no idea what they sell, mostly. All that's important for them is just to keep business going.
I wonder if they even have anything that even looks like that. That item that you were looking at, Borg Warner item, is made out of excellent product materials, and that is an expensive item. With all that stainless steel and that precision, yeah, it's going to be expensive. If you can buy that down in that junk shop you were down in, if they have those things laying around, you're probably right. They probably don't even know what they are.
Well, John, they have one for, I believe, $50. $50. You can apply the voltage to it and you have a friction. But if you want to have all of the controls whatsoever, that takes a lot of money. Now, from the place that I'm buying right now, I was cruising through the entire thousands of items that they have. No, I was talking about something else. There are plenty of stuff. Let's say a coil winder that is automatic one with six spindles whatsoever. The original price about $150,000. I checked it. They have it for $299. I don't need it. I don't buy it. It's mostly for a production. It's not for casual winding.
Well, if
they have a device similar to that, you said, for $50. You set up a